This is Susan Franson, and you are listening to Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Welcome. Our program today is an introduction of a new book, America's Climate Century, What Climate Change Means for America in the 21st Century and What Americans Can Do About It. We'll be visiting a reading with the book's author, Rob Hogue, Iowa State Senator from Cedar Rapids, held on May 29th, 2013 at Café Diem, and followed by an interview with Rob at KHOY Studios. As I walk over from the Pantorium, past the noisy street construction on Douglas, it's starting to drizzle. We've been given the use of the front platform by the windows at Diem. Rob arrives about 5 minutes after I've gotten set up, and we test KHOY's new field mic to make sure that it will catch what he has to say rather than the noise from the tables on the main level of the coffee house. Let's hear his remarks now about global climate change on this rainy May afternoon in Iowa.
I've been concerned about the climate issue for almost 30 years now, but the thing that really took it from an abstract issue to a reality for me was the unprecedented floods of 2008. And you all probably know the story of Cedar Rapids and how unprecedented that flood event was. And as I've paid attention to what's going on around the world, that's not an isolated incident. And we've had disaster after disaster after disaster, and I'm just going to say this. Since this book was printed and first available on Amazon on April 18th. We've had record flooding in San Antonio that killed several people, wildfires in California. We had the terrible tornado in Moore, Oklahoma. Other tornadoes across the South. We can talk in questions and answers about tornadoes and climate change. I actually talk about that a little bit in the book. And then, of course, we went from the worst drought in my lifetime to now flash flooding across our state. We had a man die, presumed dead yesterday in Parkersburg. Over $1 million of damage to county roads in Mitchell County from 9 inches of rain there. You've obviously had it. And on the drive over here, let me tell you, I never knew there were so many lakes in the farm fields of Iowa and so many creeks and so many rivers. It is just an incredible amount of water there. And on the Iowa River at Highway 30, it is approaching the level that it was in 2008. And that's why your nemesis, the University of Iowa, is actively sandbagging and evacuating buildings as we speak, even though there's still a beach at the Coralville Reservoir. They're getting ready. That's part of the new reality. It's why I call the 21st century the climate century, because this issue is no longer just about cutting emissions to try to prevent global warming. This is now an issue where we're in an all-out effort to not only cut emissions to prevent it from getting that much worse, but also to prepare and deal with the climatic disasters that are happening all around us. I want to read a little excerpt from the book, and I've not read this excerpt before, so we're going to see how this one does. So here we go. In May 2011, I wrote a guest column for the Des Moines Register entitled "Era of Climate Disasters Has Begun." That column was submitted as floodwaters rolled down the lower Mississippi River when the dikes protecting southeast Missouri were blown up to spare the town of Cairo, Illinois, and the town of Millington, Tennessee was inundated. While that column was pending publication, the deadly tornado tore through Joplin, Missouri. In that column, I reviewed recent climate disasters that affected Iowa, the United States, and the world. Those disasters include the floods of 2008 that struck Iowa so hard, and in 2010, Iowa had flooded again, and obviously that was included Ames and the terrible flooding in Ames that I came over and toured in August of 2010. Since I wrote that column in May 2011, there have been even more climate disasters. The United States set the record for the warmest 12-month period in our country's history, and the disasters included record heat and drought that again ravaged Texas and Oklahoma, record wildfires in Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, Oklahoma, and Montana, enormous rains in Montana that triggered flooding down the entire Missouri River Valley, including western Iowa, record floods that hammered Minot, North Dakota, and Dubuque, Iowa, Hurricane Irene and Tropical Storm Lee that brought record floods to Vermont and Pennsylvania. Overall, in 2011, the United States set a record with $14 billion disasters at a total cost over $52 billion, more than $165 per American. In 2012, there were more climate disasters. Think about how many of these you remember as I read through the list. There were more climate disasters, including nationwide drought, record flooding in Duluth, Minnesota, record rains from Tropical Storm Debbie in northern Florida, and record rains from Hurricane Isaac in parts of Louisiana. Then came Hurricane Sandy, with record storm surges through downtown New York City and across New Jersey and other East Coast states. Hurricane Sandy killed more than 100 Americans, ruined businesses, destroyed homes, disrupted public services, ruined public infrastructure, and cost our country billions. By the end of 2012, the total damage from Hurricane Sandy alone had grown to more than $70 billion, well over $200 per American. We have had so many disasters in recent years that it's hard to remember earlier disasters like Hurricane Ike, Hurricane Wilma, Hurricane Rita. Even Hurricane Katrina has become a distant memory. Serial climate disasters are unfortunately a reality of the climate century. Now, I go on to say that I know that disasters like these have happened throughout human history, occasionally with larger death tolls because societies were less prepared to deal with them. Human mismanagement in the past has contributed to disasters like the Dust Bowl and the Mississippi River flood of 1927. Even without climate change, we should be prepared for disasters like these in the future. Climate change makes the need to prepare that much more urgent. I recently heard climate change compared to steroid use by baseball players. Players have always hit home runs without steroids, but with steroids, they can hit more of them. It is not possible to say which home run was caused by steroids, but steroids increase the numbers of home runs. Likewise, climate change is contributing to more frequent and severe climate disasters today. That's part of the reality on this issue. It's not just cutting emissions, which we need to do and we've long talked about, but it's now about disaster prevention and disaster recovery. The good news is there are a lot of things we can do. I go through them in the book. You know the old book? How many people have seen the books? 50 Things You Can Do to Help the Environment, right? Remember those? I sat on the floor of the state Senate in January 2007. My first speech on the state Senate was when I turned 40 years old. And you know, most senators bring in cookies or cupcakes or things like that. I brought in compact fluorescent light bulbs because there were a lot of people who had never had one before. In it, announcing that it was my birthday, and I brought in the fluorescent light bulbs, compact fluorescents, I said, the first 40 years of my life were 50 things, we can do for the environment. We now live in an era where there are 50 things each and every one of us has to do just to give our children a sustainable future. So there are a lot of things we can do. Let me share a little excerpt about what we can do. For 30 years, Americans have debated whether to prevent global warming through emission reductions or try to adapt to climate changes as they happen. The truth is we have used the debate as an excuse to do nothing. The reality is we now urgently need to do both. On October 21, 2009, the leaders of 18 American professional scientific organizations outlined the required course of action in a letter to the United States Senate. If we are to avoid the most severe impacts of climate change, emissions of greenhouse gases must be dramatically reduced. In addition, adaptation will be necessary to address those impacts that are already unavoidable. Adaptation efforts include improved infrastructure design, more sustainable management of water and other natural resources, modified agricultural practices, and improved emergency responses to storms, floods, fires, and heat waves. Now, here's what I say about that. Now, after the heat and the drought of 2012, after Hurricane Sandy, and after all of the recent climate disasters, we know these actions are even more urgent. Like Americans before us who had to deal with global crises such as World War II and the Cold War, we have to deal with climate change. Some Americans have resisted climate action for fear it would require us to give up our way of life. But the changes we need to make do not require the greatest sacrifices in our history, not even close. We do need to make changes. We need to leave fossil fuels in the ground by using less energy, less electricity, and less gasoline. We need more energy efficiency and energy conservation. We need 100% renewable electricity. We need transportation solutions like fuel-efficient cars, electric vehicles, rail, and Main Street and downtown revitalization. We also need more staycations and teleconferencing instead of air travel, and more walkable, bikeable, and transit-friendly communities. We need more investment in infrastructure to withstand extreme weather events. We need to protect and enhance our natural resources so native wildlife and native plants can survive climate change. We need more Americans to choose to live simply so that others may simply live. But a life of drudgery is not required. What is required is for Americans to demand that our political leaders take national climate action. The fight against climate change must become our new national purpose. We must tell our elected officials and candidates that we support policies and we are willing to make changes in our lives to fight climate change and achieve sustainability. The good news is, while slashing our greenhouse gas emissions, we can build stronger, safer, healthier, more vibrant, and more prosperous communities now and for future generations. Let me just make an observation about that. I make the reference there to World War II and the Cold War, and that's really what my parents' generation was about. That defined my parents' generation. And just like my parents' generation didn't ask for those problems, we didn't ask for the problem of climate change. But what did people in my parents' generation do? Well, my dad, he enlisted in the United States Navy, joined the V-12 program, and fulfilled his tour of duty during World War II. My mother, she was a little younger. She remembers all the energy conservation they did so that, you know, kids in Iowa, like she was, wouldn't use the gasoline and the oil that America's military operations needed. This is something we can do, and as I mentioned in the passage, the good news is we can improve our health, reduce our dependence on expensive foreign oil, and really achieve sustainability and do a lot of good things. I do think this is a significant generational challenge for us. I do say in the book that if we care about our children, we have to care about this issue. You know, a child born today in 2013 is going to live to 2100 in all, you know, likelihood with life expectancy. So the truly catastrophic climatic changes that many scientists have warned us about that are possible, kids being born today may live to see them. And we need to step up and we need to take action. There's momentum in the climate system, and that's something that Americans haven't understood. I compare it to when you go to cook macaroni and cheese in the book. When you turn on that stove to boil the water, does the water instantly boil? No. It takes a while to reach the new equilibrium temperature from the blanket of gases that we've added to the atmosphere that are having a continual warming effect on the planet. And the scientists tell us we're committed irreversibly to another degree, to another 2 degrees Fahrenheit warming, even if we stopped emissions today. And that's one of the things that makes it so urgent. In the book, I compare it to the familiar story of the Titanic. And who doesn't love Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet? I know I do. It's a great movie and it's a great story and a truly tragic historical event. But you remember the story. The captain was told, sail faster, the ship's indestructible. So what did he do? He sailed faster because the ship was indestructible. And when the lookout saw the ice in front of the ship, it was too late to take precautionary action. There was still the battle to save as many lives as they could, and that's, my wife reminds me, that's part of this story. But we still need to take precautionary action to try to reduce that collision with catastrophe that so many people have predicted. I want to finish with another little segment of the book. It's a little shorter, and let me just share it with you. In the climate century, the fight against climate change needs to take its place as our new national purpose, just like winning World War II and the Cold War were America's national purpose during my parents' generation. Americans are ready to do just that. America's scientific leaders have repeatedly called for climate action. Business leaders support climate action. Faith leaders support climate action. In our military, there are increasing numbers of climate patriots who know we need to fight climate change to safeguard our country's national self-interest. Grassroots support for climate action is rapidly increasing. In every family, more people see themselves as climate parents or grannies for a livable future. After the heat and drought of 2012, after Hurricane Sandy, after so many recent climate disasters, Americans are ready for climate action. What we have been missing and what we now urgently need are strong national leaders who can pull the country together to slash greenhouse gas emissions, safeguard our people and our property in the face of growing climate disasters, and lead the world into a new global alliance for sustainability. And that's one of the reasons I'm here today, is because I am asking Iowans to help in this effort. There are several things that you can do to help in this effort, in what I consider the great challenge of our generation, which is the fight against climate change. First, every congressional district in America needs groups dedicated to climate education and advocacy. And if Hurricane Sandy doesn't get our elected officials' attention, what will it take? Are we going to have to wait till the water's there permanently? I don't think so. I think people have the capacity to change, to step up, to do the right thing. So we need people to get after Congressman King and work with him and encourage him to support climate action. There is a group that is doing district-by-district organizing. I mentioned it in the book, Citizens Climate Lobby. They do not have a group in the 4th Congressional District. That's something that's easy to do, form a group. They do a monthly telephone call on the first Saturday of each month and ask people to take a monthly action. Finally, if you'll give me an email address, I'll get you involved in Iowa Climate Advocates, which is the all-volunteer grassroots group that I coordinate. And then final thing you can do, this book really is intended as in addition to what I hope you'll find an enjoyable read and a good book to read and interesting literature and an interesting political analysis. It really is meant to get more people involved in this. I wrote this, designed this intentionally for busy people who only might have had 3 or 4 hours to give to this. It is meant to be comprehensive. It's meant to be the best summary I could of the science, the consequences, and the solutions to climate change. And I also think I've done my best to put in the context of America's history, our culture and values, why we ought to lead the world to deal with this issue. Help me make it a national bestseller. Like it on Facebook. If you like it, write a positive review on Amazon. Tell all of your friends, your family, your colleagues around the country about it. Give it a chance to really help us achieve what we need to achieve on climate change so that we can finally, as a country, as Americans, lead the world to the climate action that we so urgently need for our future. And with that, I will conclude my remarks and see if anybody has a question or a comment for the good of the group.
There were some questions, and Rob signed a few books. Then we went outside to walk over to the Mantorium for an interview. But there was no way we could step out from under the awning. It was pouring down rain. So there was nothing we could do except wait for it to let up. But considering the subject that Rob had been talking about, it did seem to have a special significance. The ferocity of the rain reminded me of the official song of the 2009 Climate Summit Conference, "A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall" by Bob Dylan. I remember how it impressed me at the time, and the refrain kept running through my head.
And I stand on the ocean until I start sinking. I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall.
Suddenly it stopped raining, so we'll hurry down the street and around the corner to the Pantorium. At least the street construction has stopped, so we won't have to contend with jackhammers and bulldozers while we're trying to record. So we go upstairs, and we're now settled in. You're listening to KHOI-FM 89.1, Story City, Ames, and I'm Susan Franson. And I'll let our guest introduce himself and tell you why he's here with us.
I'm Rob Hoag. I'm a state senator from Cedar Rapids, serving my second term in the state Senate after 2 terms in the Iowa House. And I'm here today because I'm in Ames for my tour of my new book, America's Climate Century, What Climate Change Means for America in the 21st Century and What Americans Can Do About It.
Sounds like it's pretty comprehensive.
Well, I think it is a pretty comprehensive book, but the comprehensive sometimes sounds bad because people will think it's too long. And one of the things I really worked for in this book was to do something that was short, digestible. It's 120 pages long, and yet I believe it's comprehensive of the issue. As Jennifer Hemmingson, a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, wrote, it can take you from zero to well-informed in just a few hours. And that's really what I was aiming for with the book. Having been in office now for 11 years, I know how difficult it is for people to learn about issues that they haven't lived with their whole lives. I mean, I've been living with the climate issue since I was a college student in the mid-1980s when I first learned about it. And I've studied it. I've followed it very carefully. It's just been terrible to watch all these bad things happening that have been predicted for so long, and it just keeps getting worse. But, you know, for people who haven't followed the issue, how are they going to get up to speed on it? Well, they're going to listen to the headlines from Fox News or MSNBC, and we need to get beyond those headlines and really get in a little more depth on the issue. So what I've done is written a book that's designed for elected officials, candidates, engaged, active citizens who just really want to learn more about climate change and understand why people are so concerned about it and what we can do about it.
Okay, Rob, so what do you recommend?
There are 1,000 things people need to do to deal with climate change. None of them are the greatest sacrifices that people have had to make in our history. They're changes that we need to make. The good news is a lot of those changes will improve our economy, improve health, reduce other environmental problems. So there are benefits to the action that we're talking about. But people, what we really need to do is come together as a country and understand that this is a global challenge, intergenerational challenge, and that the United States of America needs to take strong national climate action in our own country, and then lead the country abroad to deal with it. And so how do we do that as a country? We talk to our national political leaders, our elected officials. We give them a chance to change their mind when you see events like Hurricane Sandy and the floods in Iowa and the drought in Iowa and all the wildfires. When you see those things, okay, it's time to change our mind. Give them the chance. And if the elected officials today we have aren't up to task, then we've got that obligation to replace them with people who will act on this. Not just today, but understand that we're going to have to sustain this effort for the next 3 or 4 decades. But I believe if Americans can understand it, understand the parameters of this issue, we can do that. That's why I've written the book, because people need, you know, people are busy. There are all these things out here. What's a nice, short, concise, clearly written reference that I can understand this problem, and that's what I've really tried to do in the book. I know it's not everything that people need to know about climate change, but I tried to give people the basic framework so that people would feel comfortable speaking up with their political leaders, getting engaged in our discussions in the community level, state level, national level, so that we can take the action that we need to take.
Yes, I'd agree that you've written a useful handbook for those who already have some interest in the issue, who are concerned with extreme weather events, and who want to do something. But one of the things that surprised me was the way you discussed the issue as seen from a religious perspective. Could you tell our listeners how you approach this?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's a segment of the book called Faith and Climate, and I had to address that issue when I worked for Ecumenical Ministries of Iowa. And obviously, if climate change is real, which it is, but if it's real, it implicates our call as people of faith to protect creation, if that's your faith tradition, right? In my faith, it would be a creation tradition. And also to protect all of us as God's children from this. I believe that churches and faith organizations have the capacity to think globally and intergenerationally. Well, then, as I thought about it, it occurred to me in the Genesis story of Joseph in Egypt that we've actually kind of heard this story before, which is Joseph read the Pharaoh's dreams to say that there'd be 7 good years followed by 7 bad years. And he imposed a tax on all agricultural production to store up grain during the good years so they could survive the bad years. And as people know the story, Jacob and his family are forced out of Israel into Egypt, the first environmental refugees. And we know that these types of bad things can happen. But here's what Joseph did. He didn't wait for the bad stuff before he took action. And can you imagine being an Egyptian farmer back 2,500 years ago and being told that a Hebrew inmate was appointed the leader of Egypt and was going to tax your grain when times were booming? You would have said, you're nuts. Talk about skeptics. There had to be skeptics then. And yet, with God's help, Joseph was able to do what Joseph did. And it saved the people of Israel, gave them a place to flee to. You know, I mean, we're talking thousands of human lives that were saved by what Joseph did. And that's what we're called to do today, is to take action to safeguard people and property in the future. And we need to do it. Ignoring the problem doesn't make it go away. That's not going to work.
You have another biblical reference that I found interesting. You don't talk about global warming deniers or climate skeptics, which are the usual phrases used by people who feel strongly about the need for climate action. Instead, you talk about doubting Thomases. Could you describe why you use that analogy?
On the doubting Thomas story, here's the point with that. First of all, people are understandably skeptical, and in the Christian mm-hmm. tradition, in my faith, Thomas says, I'm not going to believe about Jesus until I see the holes in his hands, right? And then, of course, he sees the risen Jesus and sees the holes in his hands, and, of course, the first thing Thomas says is, my Lord and my God. Humans are understandably skeptical about things. So we've wanted to see the signs that climate change is real. Well, we're seeing them. Even today, downpours in Ames, right? All this flash flooding across the state, the flash flooding in Mitchell County. We're seeing it. We can't wait too long. We've got to act on this. The other reason I like the Thomas analogy, people can change. So you can be a doubting Thomas today, but then what did Thomas do? Thomas was a great leader for the Christian church. And, you know, I keep hoping that Americans who have been skeptical about climate will say, you know what? I see what's going on around the world. We've got to take action. And when we do, I still believe that Americans, I think the Americans are the best hope for the planet. I think we're the ones who can lead the world to deal with this issue. We need to. We're the leading economy in the world. We're the leading culture in the world. We're the leading military power in the world. We are, in many ways, still the world's only superpower. We need to understand that this is a threat to our future and organize the world to get behind an international global alliance for sustainability to take the action that we need.
So, what happens when doubting Thomases become convinced they have to change? Then what?
Can I give you another example of that, Susan?
Sure.
And I don't know how this will resonate in Ames. I grew up in Iowa City. I'm a huge Hawkeye fan. And every Saturday at Kinnick Stadium, when there's a home football game, they show a clip of Niall Kinnick speaking when he accepted his Heisman Trophy in 1939. World War II had begun. And what Niall Kinnick said was, I can speak confidently that American boys would much rather grapple for the Heisman Award than for the Croix de Guerre. And he reflected what Americans at that time believed. We don't want to get involved in another European war. Well, think about what Niall Kinnick then does. The United States gets in World War II, and of course Niall Kinnick enlists and dies in a training accident as a pilot in the Caribbean. And a radio guy in Cedar Rapids said, what are you saying? We're not patriotic if we don't believe in climate change? And I said, no, that's not the message. The message is that Americans have the capacity to change our minds. And you know, things change. There were people who, George Wallace was the symbol of segregation. And you know what? By the end of his political career, African-American voters loved him because he became a great leader for civil rights, you know, at the end of his political career. People can change. Americans can change. And this issue is, yeah, people have wanted to resist it. Oh, yeah, I don't want to have to give up my air conditioning and things like that. And they don't have to make these great sacrifices, but they do need to make changes. We need to make changes as a country if we're going to deal with effectively this problem. And you know, the stakes are high. Last summer, we lost over half our Arctic sea ice. You're seeing statistically significant climate events happening all over the place. Some of the leading scientists in the country are at Iowa State, who have just tracked this clear increase in extreme precipitation events. All this stuff is happening, and one of the things that makes that so hard is knowing the issue like I do, well, we ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, it is going to get worse. And so what we need to do now is take strong national climate action to prevent it from getting that much worse in the future.
And you don't give up on the doubting Thomases. At the end of the book, you have an appendix. You had actually 18 different points for the doubting Thomases. Basically, would put someone in the position of being informed on just about any point that would come up.
I did another radio show recently, a call-in show, and one guy in a 30-second call, I think, raised about four or five of them. And it's hard to respond to those when you're right, you know, you're under the gun, you're on the air, you're getting a call, you know there are other callers waiting. But I tried to do my best to go through each one. I'm sure I didn't do a great job. But it's hard. One of the things that's really interesting to watch, you know, and I've been watching this very carefully for over 25 years now. People used to say, well, it's not warming. Well, now it's unequivocal that it's warming. So now they're saying, oh, that's just a coincidence. It's just nature. Well, pretty hard to make that move. You know, my basic instinct tells me if something's predicted and then it happens, that's one indication that it's right. But, you know, this is probably the most thoroughly studied scientific issue of our times. And the scientists have universally organized scientific group after organized scientific group. It's not a UN conspiracy. These are American scientists, Iowa scientists, who are saying it's real, it's at least primarily caused by human activity, and it's a real danger for our future, and it's already having consequences today. You just, at some point, you've got to say, you know what, I've flirted with these alternative theories. I even say in the book, hypothetically, if they could show why additional global warming isn't going to happen or won't be a problem, I would be delighted. But that's not a rational basis for policy action. We've got to listen to the scientific community, the National Academy of Sciences, the 18 professional scientific organizations in this country in areas like meteorology, agricultural science, geophysics. Those groups are saying it's real, it's primarily driven by human activity, and it's a real danger for our future. We need to start to act on that. People don't want to believe that bad things can happen. You know, I mean, you know, oh, Chicken Little, right? Well, look at what's happened in our country over the last few years. We had a devastating hurricane hit New Orleans. A devastating hurricane hit the East Coast, Hurricane Sandy. We had unprecedented flooding in Iowa that cost our state billions. Bad things can happen. This tornado recently in Moore, Oklahoma. Bad things can happen. And so you can avoid this, try to avoid this if you want. You can continue to try to avoid it if you want. But I believe we're at a point where Americans have to unite and say, you know what, this is a major issue for our country. And now we have to take the climate action that we need to safeguard our people and our property for the future.
I'd like to read your response to the criticism that you're only preaching to the choir. But this book is also for the choir. Why? Because choir members need encouragement. Choirs need new songs to sing. Choirs need to practice. Our choir has been given the awesome responsibility of leading America in the climate century, doing the hard work of educating ourselves, of working to inform others, and of taking the climate action that is so urgently needed. This includes the responsibility of leading the world into a new global alliance for sustainability. Working together, we can do it. That's pretty inspiring, and as a member of the choir, I did find a lot of encouragement in the book. One of the things that impressed me was the number of different types of groups that were involved. For example, I was surprised by the sheer number and variety of Christian religious organizations there were. Maybe you could list them.
Well, it's the Catholic bishops, the evangelical groups, the mainline Protestant groups, all are together on this issue. It is actually one of the things that gives me hope that politically we are very, very close to a breakthrough on this issue, is the strong leadership from some of the national evangelical groups. Because, you know, they went to bat in the late 90s to protect the Endangered Species Act. Obviously, if you believe in things like Noah's Ark, you know, and that common story and preserving God's creation, well, they stepped up for the Endangered Species Act. They're now stepping up for action on climate change. Even Roberta Combs, the head of the Christian Coalition in America, has been stepping up. There are a lot of groups that are doing it. And it's not, and remember, so that's the faith perspective. And I think one of the things I try to do in the book is, again, succinctly, so people can get through it, talk about the leadership from people who call themselves climate patriots, now primarily retired military officers who are stepping up, business groups that have stepped up. They could do more, but at least at the national level, their leaders have said, yeah, we need to take climate action. Groups that I love, there are two groups I just love, Climate Parents, which is a national group, and then Grannies for a Livable Future, which is a group in Iowa City, or that was started in Iowa City. It's now broader than that, reflecting the fact that as parents and grandparents, because we care about our kids, we have to care about this issue. This is a major intergenerational issue. And what I think is happening, Susan, is all these groups are coming together. And what we've been missing is national political leadership. I think America's ready, and I think we need our national political leaders, both Republicans and Democrats, to step up and say, here's how we can tackle this problem. And by the way, while we're tackling this problem, we're going to build safer, healthier, more prosperous communities while we're at it. And I think that's a real attraction. You know, just ask people, is the fossil fuel economy working for us? The last time I put gas in the car, it was nearly $4 a gallon, the most I'd ever paid in Iowa. Well, that is just sucking money out of our economy. That's not the direction that's going to work. We need energy efficiency, renewable energy, walkable, bikeable communities, vibrant downtowns, rail. There are all kinds of solutions out there. We just need to start doing them.
You've talked about the scientific community, the religious, business, military, and citizen groups, and answers to the Doubting Thomases. Are there any government policies that you think would be helpful?
There's a group, Citizens Climate Lobby, that is advocating very hard for a carbon fee and dividend, is what it's called. And that is one of a number of policies that would really help make a difference. We need to put a price on carbon pollution. We've got to say that carbon pollution's not just allowed to be dumped for free in our atmosphere. By the way, some people don't know that greenhouse gases have been measured and are just simply building up in our atmosphere. We just passed 400 parts per million earlier this year for the first time in human history. When I was born, it was about 315 parts per million. If you go back before the Industrial Revolution, it was about 280 parts per million. The rate of increase is increasing. This is a measured fact about gases in the atmosphere that have the basic physical property of absorbing heat that would otherwise radiate into space. So no wonder the Earth is warming. I mean, that is kind of a basic common sense to understand. You put these gases out here that have that property. Well, they're going up. And one of the tools that we can use to slow that down is to put a price on carbon dioxide pollution. And the group that's out there, Citizens Climate Lobby, has a great proposal for a carbon fee and dividend. And here's how it would work. Everybody would pay for the carbon pollution, but then all of that revenue would be rebated back to all citizens on a per capita basis. Well, that gives you an incentive to conserve because you're going to get money back, but you're going to pay less in the carbon fee. And it also has a little bit of a benefit that the people who are the wealthiest and might consume the most, you know, the people who have their private jets and multiple residences, well, they're going to pay more than ordinary Iowans like you or me who, try to drive as fuel-efficient car as possible and try to do some things at home to reduce our carbon footprint. We're going to benefit economically from it. The studies are that over I think 60% of Americans would get more money back than they'd pay in the carbon fee. So that's a viable, doable thing. If Congress were to decide, well, let's keep some of the revenue to buy down the deficit, that might make sense. But here's the bottom line. Whatever the solutions we come up with are, we need Congress to do something. in 2013, after Hurricane Sandy, after all these other disasters, with all the science that's been done, isn't there something Congress could do to address climate change? There's got to be. And I contend that doesn't matter whether you're a Democrat or Republican. Congressman Latham, Congressman King can come up with stuff to do something about climate change just as well as Congressman Loebsack or Congressman Braley. There's got to be things they can do. And one other really important point on this, Susan, is the climate, the other half of the equation. That's not just about reducing emissions, which is what carbon fee and dividend addresses. It's also about dealing with all these disasters we're now having. We have got to safeguard our people and our property from these types of climate disasters. What happened in Moore, Oklahoma, on the tornado, that could have just as easily been Ames or West Des Moines. Do we have tornado-safe rooms in every building that we're building today? We ought to. And does it cost a little money? Yeah. Does it create jobs? Yeah. Will it save lives and damage in the long run? You bet it will. So that's really what we need to do, Susan, is both reduce emissions and prepare for the climate disasters. And the carbon fee and dividend from a group like Citizens Climate Lobby is one of those things that would work.
This has been a pretty probing interview, but is there still something you'd like to add?
Well, I think, Susan, I think we've kind of hit on it, but let me just say, you know, none of us asked for this problem. You know, I think sometimes people think, oh, well, you're out advocating on climate change. You want global warming. No, it's a problem that we have to deal with. That's what I'm trying to say. And I liken it to my parents' experience with World War II and the Cold War. My parents didn't ask for World War II or the Cold War. They didn't want that stuff. But yet, as citizens, they did what they had to do. And today, as citizens, we need to do what we have to do on climate change. This is particularly important for young people. If you're in college, high school, or recent graduate, if you've got people in your family who are that age, they really need to understand this issue. I hope, you know, if it's not my book, some other book, but get involved in understanding this issue, because young people today are going to live with climate change for the rest of their lives. This is an issue that is not going away. It's a reality. We have to deal with it. And, you know, the sooner as young people they learn about that issue, I think the sooner, you know, the better equipped they'll be for the 21st century, which, as the title of the book says, America's Climate Century. This is a century in which climate change is the defining historical issue of our times, and Americans need to deal with it, and we need to lead the world to deal with it.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Yeah, thank you, Susan.
This is radio station KHOI-FM, 89.1, and you've been listening to an interview with State Senator Rob Hogue for his new book, America's Climate Century, What Climate Change Means for America in the 21st Century and What Americans Can Do About It. Now it's time to listen to that song I mentioned earlier, It's a Hard Rain A-Gonna Fall, by Bob Dylan, performed by Dylan himself. It's an old song written over 50 years ago. Dylan fans argue over whether it was written during the early days of the Vietnam War or at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But either way, it's intended as a grim prophecy, and the words have an eerie ring as we face a new set of problems in the 21st century. Here's the song.
Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the sides of 12 misty mountains. I'm walking and crawling 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles from the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blood son? And what did you see, my darling young one? Some newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. A highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blind son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of the thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sounds of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a hard, 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 rains are gonna fall. And who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did he meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. And what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? What'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back out for the rain starts falling. I head for the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters. And a home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison. And the executioner's face is always well hidden. And the hunger is ugly where souls are forgotten. Where black is the color and none is the number. And I tell it and think it and speak it and breathe it. Reflect from the mountain so all souls can see it. Then I stand on the ocean until I start sinking. Then I'll know my song well before I start singing. And it's hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall.
You've been listening to KHOI's Heart of Iowa, a program featuring a patchwork quilt of artists, public speakers, and individuals of note in central Iowa. Today, we featured State Senator Rob Hoke talking about his new book, America's Climate Century. We also included a recording of Bob Dylan singing, It's a Hard Rain A-Gonna Fall. Your host and producer was Susan Branson, and the show was engineered by Rick Morrison.